The thunder of hoofs mellowed and ebbed, restraining the rhythmic sway of the coach, which now, its journey spent, rebelled against the last outcrop of rock-strewn road. At last, the silence, intruded upon only by the hedgerow choir of downland birds. The old man, lost in a twilight sleep, his head pressed deeply into the aged leather upholstery, awoke with a start.
"We be here, sir,"
boomed the voice of the coachman, his head filling the small window set for communication with the coachman's lofty perch. On alighting, the old man stood for a moment as if in silent prayer. He turned, and carefully choosing a gold sovereign from his purse, placed it graciously in the awaiting hand of the coachman. "You have done well. Have a fair journey to the inn, and meet me back on this spot as I have directed."
"That I will, sir,"
confirmed the coachman, stirring his horses into a slow gallop. The coach disappeared from sight round an outcrop of trees, and a silence, unnerving at first, descended, chilling the spine and bringing a cold sweat to the old man's brow. The chalky path was steep and slippery from a June rain shower. His progress threatened at each step by a fox or rabbit hole, or the lurking danger of a sleepy viper coiled in a chalky crevice. It seemed an eternity before he reached the gorse-strewn summit of Downland Barrier, paused in defiance against the hungry ravages of the English Channel. Here on this place of divine tranquillity, swept clean by Channel breeze, and so aptly named Beachy Head, here upon this lofty cliff-top perch he sat, to gather breath and think. "How easy for nature to sponge away the sins of man," he whispered, as if afraid to be heard. "If only time could turn reverse, or the sun sink in the east." He plucked a daisy, and holding it to the wind, cried out, "This is for you, the flower of English youth, so sorely spent. Oh, for yesterday!" He looked again towards the sea, now calm and reposed, yet in his mind a scene of phantom ships against a backcloth of gunfire, smoke, the screams of maimed men. "Am I to dream again the nightmare which has kept me from my bed on many a tear-stained night? Be rid of me for good! Leave my soul in peace!" His cries resounded in echoes one upon the other, as if the whole cliff-top plateau was filled with the cries of many men. The tears ran down his face. The daisy crushed within the clenched fist fell in salvage towards the turf. If I could but awaken from this nightmare, and dream no more of the cursed souls of former friends, laid now in their seabed graves, their shrouds held by seaweed thongs. He moved forward, carrying his weary body towards the cliff edge. Every step was pain to the tired bones. He paused, the sharpness of his eye marking carefully the rugged chalk face. "Aye, now I see you." His salt-grained hand ventured out, pointing towards a darkened ball embedded in the clean white cliff. "Aye, now I see you," he cried again. "There is your epitaph, my fine friends, be it French, Dutch, or English. There it be. We are all equal when we are dead." The old man pondered his words carefully, and looked back towards the cannonball held fast by the chalk. "How many centuries will you stay to mark the spot? And who will tell the story once you have gone?" He wiped a tear from his cheek, and lay back against the soft green turf. In 1685, 5 years before the battle, when the cannonball had lodged in the cliff, a new king had succeeded to the throne of England, a man whose sole purpose was war against all those opposed to the Roman Catholic religion. 100 years ago, he boasted, waving his arm towards the southern coast, Philip of Spain came a cropper. With England behind me, there is no fear. I rule by God's right, and in his arms I place my crown. His advisers kept silent, for the king's cloak of sovereignty was not stitched as soundly as he believed. Even the royalist army, stronger by twice than William's, seethed with undercurrents. His own brother-in-law, Lord Cornbury, had on November the 22nd deserted in William's favour, and only by the grace of God had been stopped from carrying with him some 3 regiments of horse. James, by divine right, asserted that his kingdom would remain in the Stuart blood. His heir, born that very year, would surely follow in his steps, schooled carefully under Jesuit instruction. Salisbury was a bleak, forlorn spot, edged by the windswept miles of Salisbury Plain. How different it all was from the royal apartments at Windsor Castle, which he had left to face a cold southwesterly drizzle. Maybe the journey told on his constitution. for a sickness filled his body, a feverish chill brought on by a cramping of the stomach. The news was bad. The army on the edge of revolt. "I trust no one," shouted James. And all the time the pain of his body craved the relief of sleep. On the evening of the 23rd, at a council of war, Lieutenant General Churchill, James' ablest adviser, and the Duke of Grafton, both counselled an immediate advance on William's position. Earl Feversham urged caution, indeed advocated immediate retreat. The King retired to consider. But his fever having reached a peak, suddenly his head swam, and he fell forward seeking the support of an oak bench. A fainting fit was immediately followed by an acute nosebleed, and a surgeon was called. James cried out, cursing all for his condition. Finally, as the bleeding abated, he ordered a return to London. Churchill and Grafton had in the ensuing time stolen away from the encampment, taking with them 400 troopers. James' fears had been well founded. The trap set had not been sprung. In London, political deception surged to the surface. News from all quarters was bad, but James took the tidings without emotion. Earl Danby had raised Yorkshire, the Earl of Devonshire, the county of Derby, Earl Delamere, the county of Cheshire. Even the faithful Dartmouth naval squadron surrendered to William. There was little left for James but to flee for his life to his dearest ally and friend, Louis XIV of France, and this he did, in the most formal and kingly fashion. Before leaving and showing little of the strain he must have felt, James called upon his aunt, the Queen Dowager, who was in residence at Somerset House. Finally, as if unperturbed by his grave situation, he was seen in the company of his daughter, Princess Anne, who was with her husband, was visiting the cockpit. And that night, under the cover of darkness, James crossed the Channel, arriving in France on Christmas Day, 1688. Giving a tumultuous welcome, he was borne in state to the court of Louis, and accorded all the ceremonial of a visiting sovereign.